Wankers, this train.
And that's Rosetta Tharpe. Great, great, great person. I believe we're joined by Tony Leah. Are you there, Tony?
Hi, Phil. Can you hear me?
I can hear you. I guess you can hear me.
Yeah, not very well, actually.
Oh, I'll shout.
Okay.
Yeah, we'll work on it. Do your best. Thank you very much for joining us. Now, you attended a really important meeting. Of course, it's important. It's also very interesting. This is is it an annual thing? It's Labor Notes. Tell us where you were.
Yes, it's the annual Labor Notes conference that I attended. The first time I've attended it. It was held in Chicago, and it's got a long history. It goes back some 30 or 40 years. It's a gathering place for union people, particularly unionists that believe in promoting rank-and-file initiative, rank-and-file leadership, bottom-up control of unions. Mm-hmm. It's a place where Teamsters for a Democratic Union did a lot of work over the years, and reformers from the Auto Workers Union, UAW, have always valued attending it and coordinating things. And I was happy to attend because it was quite an amazing group, about 4,500 people, unionists from across the United States, a good number from Canada, and internationally as well. I mean, some great delegations from Brazil, Mexico, a few other countries.
Mm-hmm. By the way, I just mentioned that, on the air that Harry Glasspiegel is speaking at an organization, the Workers' Action Center, and you said someone from there was attended. Is that right?
Yes, Dina Ladd, who runs the Workers' Action Center, has for many years, was one of the people at the Labor Notes Conference.
Mm-hmm. So you went to, you got a bunch of news. I mean, you mentioned Unifor. It has some history with the Labor Notes people. And there was news brought to the conference, right, about what is developing with, I said Unifor, United Auto Workers. Wow, I actually confused the two unions. How could that be? The United Auto
Workers. Yeah, UAW.
They seem okay.
Coming out of the successful strikes that the UAW had against GM, Ford, and Stellantis in the fall, it's really kicked off a lot of interest from auto workers in the non-union plants, and they're right in the midst of a massive organizing campaign. And the first plant that was coming to a vote on whether or not to join the union was the Volkswagen plant in Chattanooga, Tennessee, and their voting was held on Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, and the vote counting was Friday night. So Friday night, while many of us were at the reception being held by the Teamsters for a Democratic Union and the UAWD, the reform group in the UAW, were watching the live tabulation of the results coming in. And there's 4,300 workers in that plant. 83% of them voted. And by the end of the evening, we saw that 75% of the workers had voted for union. And that created quite giddy excitement and cheering. And for the rest of the conference, anytime anybody mentioned the word Chattanooga, there was a standing ovation. It was really quite remarkable. It's a really important breakthrough.
Yes, because Tennessee is among the what we call right-to-work states, right?
It is, yes.
This is used to be the Solid South, the Confederacy, where people proudly showed off their Confederate flags, and anti-union, anti-Catholic, anti-Jewish, anti-black, blah, blah. That was who they were, and a little bit still.
Yeah, and still are. Just prior to the vote in Chattanooga, six Southern governors issued a statement saying that workers should not support the union, and it was an attack on their values, which I guess encompasses what you're talking about, the values.
Christopher Freeland would take
workers
and wave her hat for that. Yeah, mm-hmm. Our values.
Yep.
We're free to not have a union. what can you tell us? The company is Volkswagen, what about the demographics of the workforce? Because there are still racial, et cetera, issues about the South. Do you know much about that?
I don't know much about the demographics in the Volkswagen plant. There were some of the Volkswagen workers were actually at the conference, even though the vote was going on. And the one speaker, was talking about the spirit in the workplace, how it was totally different than in the past, and the enthusiasm, and that it was the workers themselves doing the organizing. And that was a point that Sean Payne made as well, is that they were doing it differently this time. They were the leadership and everything was being from the workers themselves. And the guy who was speaking at the conference told us that he was confident they were going to win the vote, which they did. He said they were going to have their first local membership meeting yesterday, Sunday. So I presume they've had that already. So it's really taking off. I can tell you that this is part of organizing by the UAW in a whole series of plants, non-union auto plants, owned by companies like Volkswagen, Toyota, Hyundai, Honda, mostly in the South. So this is a real serious organizing effort of workers in the South. And one of the things Sean Payne said is that they told us you can't organize the South, but they're doing it. And I know that in the next plant that's up for a vote, which is the Mercedes plant in Alabama, Mercedes has a number of plants in the U.S. South that are non-union, and they established all of them in majority white communities. And I'm sure that was very deliberate. But the demographics of the workforce have changed over time, and in that plant, which is voting in the middle of May, it's now a majority black workforce.
Uh-huh.
And they're very confident of winning that one as well.
We're going to have to get Beyoncé interested in union movement. She just took over country music.
Mm-hmm.
Pardon a wild analogy. We should mention a similar phenomenon exists here. We've actually been living in a dangerous balance of union of organized plants and unorganized, and automakers with half their plants, half those plants being not union.
That's right.
And really tough to crack. And I guess we have to include Canada in the American South because they've been holding out pretty well here. The non-union places.
That's right. Toyota and Honda have big vehicle assembly operations in Ontario, and they probably have as many workers there as work for GM, Ford, and Stellantis in Canada. And they have been stubbornly non-union, and CAW and then Unifor has been notably unsuccessful in organizing them. And I think that Sean Payne put his finger on one of the biggest problems when he said that the change that was needed was to have the organizing done by the workers themselves. And I don't think that's been the practice John Payne, and it hasn't been the practice in Unifor in Canada.
No, it's been contracted out, right? The organizing.
Yeah, it's paid full-time organizers who hand out leaflets and lecture the workers on why they should join a union.
Yeah.
to put it, maybe a little bit too Stark, bluntly.
Yeah, don't speak in realistic terms. You're supposed to doll this up. So actually, yeah. But by the way, I mean, we really need that talk, because I have to say, Tony, that when you've only recently, in talking with us, been pointing out that, you know, after Sean Fain has only been in office, what, 2 years?
No, he hasn't been in office 2 years. 1 year.
1 year. And they changed the method. And they came up with a VW plant with more than 4,000 workers in Tennessee.
Yeah.
And now you were the labor
center. And that's just the start.
Yeah, well, I guess it is. But, I mean, what I want to know is that I hope somebody's already doing their homework here. I mean, did that idea of the workers organizing themselves, is that easy to implement it within a 12-month period? They get it done? Phenomenal.
Yeah. And I think
I got an expression, a single spark can start a prairie fire. Somebody got the word and
there's
said,
a good slogan.
Say, go ahead.
Sean Fain showed up for the last day of the Labor Notes conference. He'd originally been scheduled to be at the opening session, but he was, when the session opened, was sitting in Chattanooga with the workers watching the votes being counted. So, but when he did show up, he spoke a number of times, and his theme really is about you have to do things differently, and you have to change the culture, and you have to promote the rank and file. And he gave several examples of that. He talked about their bargaining, you know, how it was they were open with the members and what the demands were and what the companies were saying, and they changed the way they did the bargaining. They bargained with all three companies at once instead of just one. And then when they went on strike, it was against all three companies at once. And that was completely different. He really stressed that they were doing things differently, and they were going to, you know, continue to raise new ideas and think big and pose big questions. And that was the way to shake things up and change things. And one of the things that I'm really interested in that he spoke about is the idea of calling on workers and unions to align their contract expiries for May Day of 2028. So one of the things that they did in the auto bargaining in the U.S. is that their contracts expire the day before May Day in 2028. And he's now calling on other unions to align with that so that they can have what amounts to a general strike around broader national or international issues. And he said he's already been talking to some other unions about that, and that he's been talking to unions in
Well, he's talking about a 32-hour week, right?
About doing that.
32-hour week.
32-hour week was raised during the bargaining. It's a big idea. It's a, you know, putting back on the agenda that bargaining and workers fighting is to improve the lives of workers and to make changes.
And if you did that on May Day, that would be taking us all the way back to a place called Haymarket, which I believe is in Chicago, where that was what they were talking about.
I would recommend a short article that Sean Fain has in the publication In These Times from May of 2024. I guess it's the upcoming issue.
He's ahead of us.
But I got a copy. I picked up a copy there at the Labor Notes Conference. The title is Why May Day 2028 Could Transform Labor and the World. And he talks about the history of May Day and how it's celebrated as an official holiday in countries from Argentina to South Africa, just about everywhere except in its country of origin. And that's not a coincidence. The billionaire class and their political lackeys have done everything they can to white out the true history of the working class in our country. And he says that by, you know, what he's proposing, he believes it's possible, and that it's, he says that as working people, we must come together. We can no longer allow corporations, politicians, and borders to divide us. It's time we reclaimed May Day for the working class.
Wow. That's going to be in, it is in the May issue, in These Times.
In These Times.
Yes. And by the way, he has a Twitter account, right? People could just follow him on Twitter.
Yes.
You know, I mean, he reminds me, I wonder if, well, I should put this to you, he's starting to sound like John L. Lewis.
He's demonstrating that ability, that identifying big ideas, you know, dramatic proposals to change things and shake things up, will generate excitement and engagement by workers. So I see that connection for sure. But I think that in some ways he goes beyond John L. Lewis because of the commitment to rank and file, and that the rank and file should be in the lead. And if the UAW and Sean Fain stick to that, then that's a dramatic improvement.
Yeah. Of course, what we're actually talking about is industrial unionism and class solidarity within industries.
Yes. And that was John L. Lewis, by the way. And he goes out of his way time and again to say that, you know, this is not just for the United States. First of all, he uses the term working class all the time, and class struggle, and workers against the billionaire class. But he also says corporate greed doesn't recognize borders, neither should our solidarity. And, you know, he talks about, you know, building international solidarity of workers. So if they stick to that direction, you know, I think that it's really going to have, you know, bring about some dramatic changes and hold out the promise of really mobilizing workers to fight in their own interests, in their class interests.
Yeah. Well, by the way, it's time to mention something here. We're speaking to Tony Lee of Unifor, General Motors, Oshawa, legendary spot. And Tony, you have a book coming out. It's called Truth About the Truth About the 37 Oshawa General Motors Strike. The subtitle is They Made Cars and They Made Plans. Reds, the Rank and File, and International Solidarity Unionized General Motors. Baraka Books is bringing this book out, and the first paragraph of one of the announcements I have is the truth about the 37 Oshawa General Motors strike tells the dramatic story of the historic 15-day strike by 3,700 workers at a key General Motors plant. It was a bitterly fought strike that pitted them against a rabidly anti-union government, hostile press, and powerful corporations. So what else is new, I add? The success of the strike established industrial unionism in Canada. The truth about the 37 Oshawa GM strike. Go to Baraka Books, by the way. It's posted the both this, the announcement, the cover, and the book will be out. We're hoping, I guess maybe what, we anticipate late summer, fall. What?
In the fall, but it's available for pre-order now. If you go to the Baraka Books website.
By the way, you shared this information with people at the Labor Notes. What did people take an interest? Did they know something about it, or did it?
I don't think that people knew a lot about it. They were interested, you know, because of the connection with the Flint sit-down strike. Mm-hmm. Which is, you know, known, of course, by a lot of people in the labor movement and historians
and the
Flint sit-down strike was just weeks, concluded just weeks before the Oshawa strike. So I found a lot of interest in it. Yeah, I distributed you know, some flyers about the upcoming book and talked to a lot of people. One of the sessions that I attended was about the history of the UAW and Reuther's role and, you know, assessing Reuther's contribution, positive or negative.
Well, by the way, you're not a Reutherist. What did they conclude? Let's do it on numbers. So 1 to 10, where did they put him?
Well, they had one historian there who was pro-Reuther, and one who we may have talked about before, Tony Gilpin, who has a fabulous book about that period, focusing on the Farm Equipment Workers Union, which was a communist-led union, and she was much more cognizant of the failures of the Reuther administration, and particularly how
they handled McCarthyism.
UAW suffered from his removal of the left and concentration of power.
He practiced McCarthyism.
To a debate.
Am I right? He practiced McCarthyism.
Yeah, he brought McCarthyism into the labor movement. He used McCarthyism to consolidate his control. He supported the Taft-Hartley loyalty oaths, which, you know, decimated the ranks of progressive labor people and eliminated a lot of the people who had built the CIO unions.
Yeah. But they didn't take a straw vote. What would you think the sense of the room was? By the way, this is a touchy subject, right? Sean Fain often cites Walter Reuther.
It is. Reuther has been an icon or made a hero of the labor movement and certainly of the UAW for a long time. The reason that people are willing to look critically now is that in order to transform the UAW, they had to get rid of what was called the Reuther Caucus, the structure that had been built to control the union from the top down.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that after having, you know, spent years fighting the Reuther Caucus and finally defeating it, you know, they're maybe more open to looking at Reuther himself and having a more sober assessment of his record and contribution.
We're looking for the word nuanced. people can toss out memories, but, you know, he was one of the people who organized the March on Washington. Martin Luther King spoke at.
Yeah, I missed that bit. Sorry.
Oh, I said Reuther himself was involved in promoting the March on Washington.
Yes, and people talked about the March on Washington. You know, that was positive. I would argue that the UAW was better on fighting racism before Reuther than once he took over. He resisted having any black representation on the International Executive Board, for example, up until the 1960s, even though it had been called for, you know, 30 years before.
Right. So in other words, he moved because the base underneath him moved. And so he moved. Is that right?
Yeah. Eventually. It took a long time. And it wasn't reflected, you know, in the structures of the union, in the locals or anywhere else, you know, until black workers themselves fought to achieve that. But there was a much more of a commitment at the time of the founding of the union and up until Reuther took over. I'm holding in my hand a booklet that the UAW Education Department issued in 1943 called To Unite Regardless, and it's got a picture on the cover of a white worker and a black worker shaking hands. Mm-hmm. It's got the history of the strike at the Ford Rouge in 1941, which would not have been successful except for the role of black workers and the commitment of the union to fighting racism and organizing the black workers. It's got a picture in it of Paul Robeson addressing one of the Ford rallies during the organizing effort.
Mm-hmm.
It's got on the back the Cadillac Charter that the UAW endorsed for against discrimination in public housing and jobs and
what's the
training.
Year? The year?
1943.
Wonderful.
4 years before Reuther took over and fired everybody that was connected with this kind of progressive work.
So the prosecution remains in place. Now, we're speaking to Tony Leah. We're talking, by the way, I'll remind you, the book, because you can pre-order now at Baraka Books, and it's called The Truth About the 37 Oshawa GM Strike. Mayor of the city spoke. What's that about?
Yes.
By the way, do you know anything comparable in Canada? Maybe in Quebec they do this stuff, but in English Canada, this is a political desert.
It sure was a dramatic moment. Brandon Johnson gave a welcoming address at the opening plenary of the conference. He had been a teacher. He was an organizer for the Chicago Teachers Union and helped organize their strike in 2012. He was elected as mayor of Chicago just last year. One of the people who endorsed his mayoralty campaign was Jesse Jackson. And apparently he's the third black mayor of Chicago and the first mayor of Chicago coming from the west side since 1933.
The side business is a touchy subject with Chicago.
Gave a good welcome to people and mentioned that back in the day he'd been an attendee at a Labor Notes conference.
The reason we talk about these things is anytime somebody has a good idea, it ought to be followed up by, you know, others. And we seem to be locked here in these discussions, shorter work week, international solidarity, I mean, the real thing, and participation of mayors, and it doesn't happen. It's an interesting headache. We need to go into that. Let's mention, too, you told me prior to the interview that while you were having the conference, a Gaza demonstration marched by.
Yes.
Talk about that.
Yeah, Labor for Palestine had organized a demonstration. There may have been other groups in the community as well, supporters of Palestinians and against the what's going on in the assault on Gaza. And the police apparently arrested a couple of people at the demonstration just outside the hotel where the conference was taking place. And people came rushing into the conference. It was while the mayor was speaking and were telling people that, people had been arrested and calling for people to come, intervene. It was a little bit disruptive and disorienting because I'm sure a lot of people didn't know what was going on and why there was shouting from the back. But apparently we learned later that the conference organizers and people from the mayor's office intervened and were able to get the two people who had been arrested released.
Really? Now, this is subsequent. In other words, you learned hours later or the next day.
We learned later the next morning, really. Because at the opening plenary the next morning, it was announced that the what had happened, and that was prefaced by the speaker saying how important the issue of Palestine was, and that the ongoing genocide in Gaza needed to be opposed.
And, who said that?
Described what had happened the day before, and also mentioned that there were several workshops during the course of the conference dealing with Palestine and support for Palestine and international workers' support for Palestine. And that received a very warm applause from the delegates. And I do want to mention, I saw many, many delegates who were wearing keffiyehs and Palestine flag buttons. And,
keffiyehs.
There was very evident support for
Did you
for
warn
Palestine.
Them that they if they come to Canada and they go anywhere near Queen's Park, that the speaker there is going to take their keffiyeh away? Because he's a champion of free speech. And He knows what people should wear and not wear. Actually, it's a very embarrassing moment. I hope people learn about this. It's so ignorant. Even Doug Ford noticed that it was ignorant. And so if that's a low bar. If he notices, it's pretty blatant. That march past, that was coincidental? Or were they coming there wanting to call Labor Notes conferences' attention to the Gaza situation?
I don't know.
You don't know.
I'm not close enough to the organizers of the conference, or I didn't get any sense of that or information about it. So I can't really say.
Yeah, somebody felt strongly enough about it that they made an announcement following that, saying that the mayor and others had helped to resolve the situation and have people released.
Yes.
That is a great story, I got to tell you. And again, we're speaking to Tony Leah, uniform GM, Oshawa, retired. I better ask you about this weekend meeting, and I think we have a few minutes left. The Toronto Star has a headline, Polyev slammed at as no friend to workers at National Summit, and the Canadian Labour Congress president, her name is Brusk. That's a kind of a cool name, actually, for being the Labour leader. But they didn't invite Mr. Polyev, why should they? But Justin Trudeau was there. By the way, he reminded everybody that he's in the teachers' union, so he's really cool. He's really on top of it. And then Jagmeet Singh. I got two subjects there. They don't seem to talk about Gaza at all, ever. I know that in January, we sent a guy with a lamp and mining equipment to the bottoms of the CLC press releases, and they did say something in January. It is now April. They don't take up this subject. And their confreres in AFL-CIO, they don't. You got an explanation of why?
I'm struggling with the CLC because, they've made some changes and they claim to be, being more progressive and more responsive. But in terms of foreign policy, it seems like they are an adjunct to the Canadian government's... They follow along with whatever... the federal government does. That's certainly the case in the United States. The AFL-CIO has been like an arm of the State Department and gets funding from the National Endowment for Democracy, which they then spend to support U.S. foreign policy in around the world. I had a quick look at the CLC website, and of course one of the statements that they have on there is how they stand in solidarity with Ukraine and condemn Russian aggression.
So their little eyes do pop open when the masters of these two countries decide to engage in adventurism in Europe,
yes.
But their little eyes are closed when 40,000 Gazans are killed.
The tone is totally different. They've only had one statement on the situation in Gaza, and it is not. They don't say we stand with Gaza. We don't. It doesn't say we condemn the Israeli assault and genocide. It does call for ceasefire, but it also mentions meeting with Histadrut, it's that attempt to be dealing with it as a, you know, mm-hmm. as two equal sides in some bizarre view of the world. So it is very different.
And lastly, quick question. There was a time when the CLC would invite the NDP and did not regard the Liberal Party as somebody to come to their conference. Is that true?
Yeah, the NDP was formed as a combination of the old CCF and the CLC, the labor movement. And the labor movement and the CLC supported the NDP unequivocally for many, many years. And but more recently, it's there are closer and closer ties with the Liberals. We saw that with Hassan Youssef, who got his reward for his support of the Liberals.
He's a senator.
A seat in the Senate, which he's still sitting on. And this recent meeting that you've referenced was a meeting of the CLC Council, which is the their top body, and so it's all of the leaders of the major unions in Canada sitting around the table.
I'm sorry to cut you off. I'm afraid we're going to have to go. I thank the Tony.
Okay,
Tony Leo, thank you very, very much. We'll have you on again soon because there's a whole bunch more stuff. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Phil.
Taylor Report, CIT. And thank you, Pedro. And 33-45-78, Steve Fruitman coming up.